All right, well, we are so glad to have all of you here for the conference. Praise the Lord. I know some of you have traveled a long way to be here, and so we're just praising the Lord that you guys are able to come. This was the first year that Southern was able to host this conference, and they've just done a wonderful job, and so we thank the Lord for that. I wanted to, before I really jumped into our session, just real quickly introduce myself. Some of you I know well. Some of you I'm getting to know. Dick DeMerchant, who's sitting over here in the front to my right, was one of the brave souls that hired me to be his youth pastor at First Baptist Lenore City back many moons ago, and so it means a lot to me to have Dick here. Dick could tell you many frightening stories about Steve Wright and many failures, but he coached me along. So, but it is a real blessing to have Dick here. He's been a mentor to me through my ministry life. I grew up in Gainesville, Georgia. A lot of people think that I grew up in New Jersey when they hear me talk. They hear the accent and get that confused, but I'm a Georgia boy. And went to college at Carson Newman. And the young lady that you see in this picture with me is Tina. And we had a guy introduce us. There was a guy on my wrestling team who we were driving back from a trip. And he said, "Steve, there's a girl at our school that you need to meet." And this guy on our wrestling team, his name was Joey. And Joey wasn't living for Christ. And he was into a lot of things that he shouldn't have been into. And so when he said that he wanted to introduce me to this young lady, I thought, now, I couldn't quite make the connection. But I said, later on, I asked Joey, I said, "Joey, why in the world do you think, if you know this young lady and you're friends with her, that I would be interested in her? I mean, what's the connection?" And so he said, no, I really don't know her. She's just sweet mates with my girlfriend, and I figured you would like to get to know her because she's just like you. She doesn't like to have any fun either." And so a couple of days later, I went to the cafeteria, and I had two black eyes. A guy had punched me in the nose in a wrestling match, and I had two black eyes. I looked like a raccoon. And went over and met Tina, and she fell madly in love with me at that moment. I wish I could say that were true, but she had great compassion and mercy and put up with me, and I began the pursuit. And God has blessed us. We have three children, Sarah, who will be 19 October 4th, William, who is 17, and Tyler, who is 15. So we have two high schoolers and one that we just sent to college. I mentioned that I'm from Georgia. Are any of you from Georgia in the room? Okay. I'm from Gainesville, Georgia. I don't know if many of you know much about Gainesville, but Gainesville is about an hour north of Atlanta. And Gainesville is the poultry capital of the world. Just write that down. That would be good for your notes later. But I always tell people, had I not met Christ, I probably would be like the head chicken catcher, maybe, you know, by now. I'm 45, and so if I would have worked hard, I might could have moved up the ranks. A lot of chickens. I mean, you're driving down the road going to school in Gainesville, and a lot of two-lane roads, and that chicken truck, when it gets in front of you, you might want to just, you know, drop back a little bit, and because that chicken truck, you could mess your car up. So I grew up in the poultry capital of the world, and if any of you men in the room are about to have like an anniversary or something, and you want to do something really unique, you could bring your wife to Gainesville. And you could go to downtown Gainesville. There's a monument, big, tall monument, and on the top of it, there's a rooster. And you could bring your wife, and for your anniversary, you could get your pictures taken right there at the chicken monument. But I did not, when I grew up in Georgia, did not grow up as a believer, and went to college. And when I got to college, there was a guy on my wrestling team. His name was Gil Bates. I don't know if you guys, any of you have ever saw that TV show called The Duggar Family, the one that has a lot of wives. She has how many children?
A lot of kids.
She has a lot of kids.
Since she had a lot of wives.
Oh, did I say wives? It's been a long night. She has a lot of children, like 18 or so, 19 and counting, something like that. Well, sometimes on that show, they go to a family's house in Knoxville, Tennessee to visit the Bates family. Well, that family, the Bates, Mr. Bates, Gil Bates, is a guy that was on my wrestling team that led me to Christ. And just a neat testimony. Gil loves the Lord, his family. It's really have been a blessing to us, and it's just been a joy. Well, the name of our conference or our session today is, as you know, Ready, Set, Go. And it basically, the outline is strategies for equipping parents. What does it look like for parents to have an intentional plan of discipleship for their children? Technically, what we should be able to do in a seminar like this, we probably and perhaps could, but technically what we should be able to do in a seminar like this is just say, okay, here's the question. What are you doing that is working where you are? Not what are you doing and what is working in your church? Because I think a lot of times when we start thinking about this intentional plan of discipleship, we start thinking of programs and things that we're going to start doing, programming at church. But the greater question is this, and perhaps, and maybe at the end, maybe we will have a few moments to do this, but the real question, the real center cut of this whole topic and this conversation is this. If you were to model this way for those in your body, and they were to ask you, or ask me, Steve, tell me, what are you doing in your home that's working for you, that's producing lasting discipleship and lasting faith in your children? So before we ever start designing, you know, Sunday morning and Thursday night, and we're going to do this at church, and we're going to have this big meeting, and da-da, before we ever get to any of that, the greater question is this: what are we doing in our life and in our home to pass this faith on to our children? Psalm 78, one generation commending the gospel to the next so that they may put their hope in God. What are we doing? And we know that this is a biblical concept because we see in 1 Peter or 1 Timothy chapter 3, when God laid out the biblical qualifications for leader, the litmus test that he gave us in that design was what? How are they doing it in the home? Now, think about this practically just for a moment, okay? That scripture, as it lays out the qualifications for the leader, it could have said a lot of things, couldn't it? It could have said, choose people that will be pastors and leaders and elders and deacons in your church. Choose men from among your congregation, from your body, that have gone on 15 mission trips. They're focused on missions. It could have said tithers, givers, men who pray well. It could have said any of those things. But the litmus test that was given by God to Paul to write to Timothy was this idea of what is working. Now, think about this just for a moment. We'll have a little fun with this, perhaps. Ready, set, go. A great question for us to ponder during this hour that we're going to spend together is really this. Go where? A few weeks ago, my family and I were down at the beach, and when you have teenage boys like William and Tyler, they're very active, and they're always wanting to do things to challenge me. And I think it's kind of like the deer syndrome. You know, you've got the two deer that are out there fighting it. You know, they're wanting to lock horns with Dad and see what they can do better than Dad at now. And so we're down at the beach, and so, you know, it's not uncommon, no matter what we're doing, but we're at the beach, and on this day they go, Dad, you know what, I think if we raced, I could beat you. I'm like, well, there's no way. They're like, yeah, there is a way. and we're about to show you. I'm like, well, let's do it. Well, we get ready to race, and the very first thing we did, you know, we line up, and here's William and Tyler. So I think, well, you know, if we're going to race, and if I'm going to win, you guys hang on a minute because we got to know where we're going to race to. So I take about 3 steps, and I draw out the finish line because, you know, I didn't want to really humiliate them and spend a lot of time running when we're at the beach when we could rest and, you know, relax. So the guys are looking at me, and they're like, Dad, is that – we need to run further than that. So they made me go a little bit further. But the first thing that we had to define, the first thing that we had to lay out was finish line. What are we actually shooting for, right? Now think about this for a moment. Can you think of any objective, anything that we try to pursue in life that we do not first try to have this idea somewhere out there of what it is that we're actually trying to shoot for, where we're going, right? I think of it, for example, like in the analogy, sports make great analogies, but I could imagine us being in a huddle and we get ready to run a play and we go, okay, here's the play. What we're going to do, this when we snap the ball, we're going to turn around and we're going to give the ball to Mr. Paul here. We're going to hand the ball off to Paul. Everybody good with that? Let's do it. And guys coming up to the line going, well, what do you want us to do? Well, don't worry about it. We're just going to give it to Paul, and then, you know, we'll let all the other guys see if they can tackle him. I'm sure he's a great athlete, and it won't happen. But it helps when we have things defined and we have things laid out, and there's a purpose to what we're doing, and we actually know what we're shooting for. So what is this with our students or with our children? Well, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11, I think, gives us a great idea of what that finish line is. And in that passage, the verse says that God has written what on the hearts of men and women?
Eternity.
And so one of the things that's so critical for us to understand in this whole conversation as we're talking about this is we have to really help parents in our ministry define what that finish line is, because if we're not careful, back to the race at the beach example, parents, all of us, there's a tendency for us to say, you know what, the win for us, and to walk out here about 2 or 3 steps and draw the line in the sand, but that's not really biblically the line that needs to be drawn. So this idea that God has written eternity and put eternity in the hearts of men, women, boys, and girls is so critical that we understand. It's vital. Because if we don't understand that, what we might end up being tempted to run after is behavior modification, right? We may be tempted to run after academics. We may be tempted to say, man, you know, the goal, and I hear this a lot, but I hear parents say, you know what, my goal and my wife and I, our goal is to help our children have it better than what we had it. Have any of you ever heard that statement a lot? Okay, you know, I want my kids to have it better. And isn't there something when you hear that, it's just, you just warms your heart and you're just like, man, that sounds pretty good. I mean, but what happens is what they're actually doing is they're setting a finish line out there. But here's the $1,000 question about that statement. What is better than what I have it or better than I had it? What does that mean? It's a good question to ask. Because if having it better than what I had it growing up means I want my children to have a heart and passion that runs after God more than me, well, that would be pretty good. If I want my children to have it better than me, I want them to be passionate about missions, I want them to have an intimate prayer life, I want them to know God, that would be wonderful. But many times, what they actually mean when they're saying, I want my kids to have it better than me, is this. I want my kids to have a bigger house, a better job, better security at work, better education. And while there might not be anything necessarily wrong with some of those things, It's not the end pursuit of the passion of, that Christ has for us to live, right? And so it's important that we realize that. Now, it's also important for us as we seek to live this out, to realize this. If you are a shepherd at your church, or you're a pastor, or you're a leader, or you're a lay leader in some way, shape, or form, it's difficult for you to take people on a journey that you've never been on. And one of the speakers said this yesterday. I believe it was Randy at the end when they asked him the question, why do you think that this is not preached more in our churches? And basically what Randy was alluding to is it's difficult for pastors to stand up and talk about family worship and how they're discipling their children and doing all of these things if they're not doing it in their home. But that is also true for us. When I was in high school, or actually when I was in middle school, I was on the football team, and you guys, all of you probably look at me and go, well, I can see why. I can see why most of these coaches would have wanted you, because when I was in the eighth grade, I weighed 65 pounds. I mean, I was as big as a mic stand. I was about this big around, and went out for the football team, and a guy by the name of Hoyt Winkler tackled me one day, and when he tackled me for about 25, 30 yards. So I realized after that play that I probably, my NFL career wasn't going to go so well, okay? So I found out that there was a sport named, a sport called wrestling. And what they allow you to do in the sport of wrestling is compete against people that are your own size. Now think about this for a moment. I thought this is the perfect sport for me, because if they can find anybody else in the state of Georgia that is in the eighth grade that weighs 65 pounds, I'd like to meet him. I would love to meet him. So I'm at practice. I'm a wrestler. We're out there, you know, and by the end of the year, they had actually found two other guys in the state of Georgia. And at the state championship, we get ready to compete, and there's three people in my weight class. Now watch this. If you guys know how they do brackets for tournaments, this is what happened. Up here with these two guys, they had to wrestle each other to see who won to come here. Here, because I'm down here, the third wheel, I didn't have anybody to wrestle, so I got an automatic bye into the finals, which meant I was going to be a silver medalist. I mean, right off the bat, I was that good. Well, so I'm in the finals of this match, and I'm wrestling this other guy. And at the end of the match, I mean, it was kind of like gladiators. Yeah, I mean, these two 65-pound monsters just out there competing. Braveheart would come to mind, other just epic things like that. And so these two, just imagine, massive athletic specimens out there competing with each other in wrestling singlets, which, if you could let your mind go, it's a pretty scary sight. So I'm wrestling this guy, and at the end of the match, we begin to fall together, and somehow I land on top. And maybe we fell, and my arm was on top of his back. I don't really even know. But, like, at the end of the match, the ref said, Green, 2 points. The match was over. I won, and I am the state champion for the sport in the whole state of Georgia. And I put my medal on. It was great. But here's something that was pretty ironic that happened in this progression. At the end of that match, a guy sat down beside me, and he said, Steve, man, congratulations. Man, that was really impressive. And I was like, you think? Obviously, it was. I mean, I'm the state champion. He said, did you know this? There's never, ever been a person in the state of Georgia who has won a national championship at the collegiate level. It's never happened. And, you know, I was just watching you. You could be that guy one day. And I thought, wow, man, I can't believe Georgia has been so lame not to have one of those. And I went home that night, and I took out a little index card, and I wrote down on this index card, Steve Wright will become the first person in the state of Georgia to be a national champion in the sport of wrestling. Went and put that on my mirror. That way, when I was flexing, you guys never did this, but, you know, every night looking at my big muscles, I could see this goal, this idea. And what the problem I ran into was this, though. When I went back to my school, I realized The next year, we had a new wrestling coach. The year after that, there was another wrestling coach. The year after that, there was another wrestling coach. So every year, 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, every year we had a different wrestling coach. And guess what was unique about these wrestling coaches? None of them had ever wrestled. One of them had never even gone to a wrestling match. I mean, so I had all of these wrestling coaches telling me how to compete and how to wrestle and how to get to the next level. And remember my goal, right? I wanted to be a national champion, not just an average wrestler. And I had all of these guys working with me. They had never, makes no sense. So my senior year, I transferred, went to a different school, wrestled for a coach who actually had wrestled in college, which that was refreshing to learn that the last 5 years I had learned everything wrong. So that was neat. But he worked with me and coached me and taught me and said, Steve, if you're going to get a scholarship, this is what you're going to have to do. And when I was in college and continued to wrestle, he would show up and come to my matches. And it was neat because he had been there. He had wrestled. He had been there. And it's important for you and I to realize in this whole argument, if you and I are going to, you know, look, we can get caught up on fads, and I know we're bad about doing that in evangelical circles, and man, this is the new trend that's out there, so, you know, we want to be a part of it. And it's great to talk about family ministry, but the critical thing for you and I is to make sure that we're doing this in our own homes, that we're loving our wives, that we're praying with our wives, that we're shepherding our wives, that we're loving our children, that we're mentoring our children, that we're discipling our children, that we're leading our children, that we're teaching our children to be on mission with us. It's critical. Then when people come to you and they say, hey, can you tell me how you're doing it? Can you tell me? And then we begin to lay out programs at the church, and we begin to do things at the church, and we begin to talk about things that we would like. It's things that are bathed out of the incubator of life that we're living. Okay? It's the message of who we are. And that it's so critical that we get this. I'm going to see if I can pull this up for you guys. I want to show you a picture of my daughter. This is a picture of my daughter that just graduated high school. Her name is Sarah. Let's see, how do you do this? I'm new to the Mac, so. Well, you can see her right there. I'll just pull it up like this. This is a young man that she worked with in Kampala, Uganda. She was over there this summer, and this guy's name is Edwin. And Sarah came back from Uganda, and she said, Dad, I want us to adopt Edwin. Met him. He doesn't have a mom and dad. He sleeps on the street every day. I want us to adopt Edwin. In Uganda, and it's difficult for us to wrap our brains around this, but in Uganda there are 2 million children that sleep on the streets every night. If I were to say, to come into to this room right now and say, hey, listen, when I came up here, did y'all see the 2-year-old kid, the 4-year-old kid that was out in the parking lot, mom, dad, nobody was there. Most of us would leave this conference room right now. We'd go get the kid. On Southern Seminary campus, 1 kid. And so in Kampala, Uganda, 2 million kids, we can't even wrap our brains around how massive this is. And these kids, when Sarah went over there at night, the kids were so excited because Sarah and the team had taken these bags and they didn't know what they had wanted them for. And basically it was like potato sacks. And these kids had these old potato sacks, and these kids would at night step into these potato sacks and pull them up as far as they would go. Some of them, only their potato sack would only come up to here. Some of them would come all the way up. And they would rip off a piece of cardboard because, I mean, think about it. Nobody would want to sleep with their face on the dirt. So they would rip off a little piece of cardboard and they would lay their face on that piece of cardboard. And that was their pillow. And while these kids sleep on the streets, unprotected, abuse, you can imagine, is rampant. The struggles that they face of not having a mom and dad speaking into them. And so my daughter goes to Kampala, Uganda. She's like, "Dad, we have to do something about this." And I said, I asked Sarah, because we've been talking about this idea of us being missional as a family for a long time. And I said, "Sarah, let me ask you a question. Whose responsibility is this? Is this the U.S. government's? Is this the Ugandan government? Is this a neglectful mom and dad? Maybe we need to just shake them and say, 'Hey, you need to...'" She said, "No, Dad, it's my responsibility." And it's been amazing. Last Friday, Saturday, and some of you guys were in my conference, or the little pre-thing that we did before the conference. This past Saturday, my wife and I, Tina, took Sarah to college. Don't even get me started on that. I'll tear up just in that alone. But on Friday, my daughter and I went out, kind of like our last lunch before she embarks into life. 45 minutes of our conversation wasn't about school, wasn't about college, wasn't about classes. It was about, "Dad, what are we going to do to minister to these kids that have no hope apart from Christ?" The night that she got back from Uganda, she had not slept that whole night, and from arrived in Raleigh at 11 o'clock. From 11 o'clock to 1:30, sat on Tina's and my bed talking about Uganda, all of the things that she had seen. And she said, "Dad, listen, I looked at my schedule. I'm supposed to get out of class like on December the 12th. So I'd like to get tickets to go back to Uganda on December, the very next day. And so just want to make sure that you and Mom are okay with that." Now, the first time that she went with a team. Okay, and so there's men and group. Now she's wanting to go back with one other girl her age to work with missions in this environment. I said, "Sarah, do you have any idea as an 18-year-old girl how dangerous it is for you to be in such a sexually charged environment, for you to be in such a dangerous place? Do you have a clue that the harm, the safety issues that..." And she said, "Dad, listen, for the last 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, all I've heard you preach about was that unless we go, and unless we tell people about Jesus, that they have no hope apart from Him. And yes, I know the risk and I know the dangers, but if nobody else goes and tells these kids about Jesus and gets them off the street, who's going to do it?" And I said, "Well, Sarah, the reason I asked that question, you know, those sermons that you heard your daddy preaching, that was for all the other boys and girls, not you." And she said, "Well, Dad, you're terrible," or whatever it was. And she said, "Dad, you're just impossible. I'm going to go check on airline tickets." And over the next couple of weeks, she had raised like $2,000 to get Edwin and another boy off the street on her own. When we sat there at that lunch that I had mentioned to you guys, Sarah said to me, "Dad, we were able to raise $2,000, or I was able to raise $2,000 in the last 2 weeks. What if over the next 4 years of college, I was able to do that 98 more times?" I want you guys to write this down if you've got something to write with, because I think this will encourage you, and it has a lot to say about the conversation that we're having. The least of these, 2540.blogspot.com. The least of these, 2540, that would be Matthew 2540, .blogspot.com. I was flying up here, and my daughter, Sarah, sent me a text. She said, "Dad, we started a blog to kind of help out with this." One of Sarah's heroes is a young lady by the name of Abby Tracy. And if you know me, you probably have heard me talk about Abby. Abby is a 22-year-old girl who lives in Uganda and works with these street kids. And when Abby was a sophomore in college, she raised $25,000 to build so that she'd have money to build a home in Kampala, Uganda. And so her sophomore year, she raised the funds. Her junior year, here's just a normal young girl, had, you know, she never led a construction project, okay? 20 at the time was 20 years old, raised $25,000. And then her junior and senior year, she oversaw the project of this house being built in Uganda so that when she graduated the very next day, she could fly to Uganda and begin getting these kids off the street. Remember earlier we were talking about that finish line? The finish line, I believe, is for us is this. Last February, when Abby was in our house, I had invited maybe 25 or 30 girls from our college ministry to come into our house because I wanted them to meet Abby. I wanted them to hear her heart and her passion. And Abby sat there, and I wish you could meet Abby. She sat there with her like a mom. Like a grandmother. She had that picture book, and she said, "Hey, now let me show you these pictures." And she began to open it. She said, "Let me introduce you to Singe. Singe, this guy, when I met him on the streets, oh my goodness, let me tell you all of the things that he was doing. And let me introduce you to Edwin. Edwin," and she just started going through page after page after page of children that she had rescued off the streets. And so Abby's going through this, and she's weeping and sharing stories about these children. And listen to this. In the middle of it, I called time out, and I said, "Abby, I said, can I ask a question? Here's a question I want to ask you. You're 22 years old. And so for you, it's not like one person trying to raise support for yourself to go, because some people... If you guys know any missionaries, I mean, that's tough to do, right? Here's a 22-year-old girl. She has raised money for herself, two other American missionaries, the house, and about 50 children. I said, "Abby, can I ask you this a question? You're 22. You just graduated. Shouldn't you be running after a career? You know, get your job started. You know, it's time to get that whole deal going. New car, updating your Facebook status, iPhone, you know." And I confess, I said, "Look, I don't even know what 22-year-old girls should be doing, but shouldn't you be doing whatever's normal?" And so I go through that list, and I'll never forget Abby in a gentle way rebuking a 44-year-old pastor in a very kind and gracious way, but making this statement: "Pastor Steve, why would I want to run my life after all of those things that you just mentioned? They're temporal. They're fleeting. They're fading. They're passing away. Why would I want to run after all of those things that are not fulfilling when I can pursue Christ and run after children who do not have moms and dads, and I can put them in homes, and I can tell them about the hope of Christ?" And I'm convicted at times that for us in Christian, inside the church, that Christianity has become this idea that if you have Christ, He'll make you more successful. If you want Christ, He'll make you more successful. If you want Christ, He will make you more comfortable. And in this whole idea of pursuing Christ and Christianity, it's this idea that we just keep accumulating. I forgot the guy who made this statement. It might have been Calvin, but said, "Many of us are willing to be Christ-centered as long as we think that God is man-centered." We're willing to be God-centered, But as long as He will prevent us from suffering, as long as He will keep us from persecution, as long as He will keep us in safety, as long as He will allow us to live in neighborhoods that are safe, and as long as we do not have to do anything radical, hey, we're good with it. But I have noticed this with the teenagers and the children, and even in my home, as I have tried to impress upon my children this idea of being on mission for God, my children have salivated. My children have ran to this. My children have taken hold of this, and they're like, this is what I want to be about. And I can tell you this because there's so many of these studies that have come out about teenagers walking away from their faith when they enter into high school. And the honest truth is, they really probably never had it. Nobody wants to say that. But we know that the theme that runs through all of Scripture is an enduring faith. Right? It's a faith that continues, and you can take a Joseph and you can take him through circumstance after circumstance after circumstance after circumstance of everything that this life throws against him. And what does he do? He stands firm. And you can do that with Daniel, and you can do that with Paul, and you can do that with Peter, and you can do that with the disciples, and you can do that with Peter. Peter, if you don't quit preaching, we're going to kill you. Well, I can't stop. And so it's very, very important before we even start talking about the practices of, hey, because this is the way that we're so programmed to think. This idea of, man, I want to be about this gospel-centered parenting, and I want to be about this idea of a faith in my children that is so passionate. The mistake that we can't make any longer is this, that all we want our kids to do is to just make it through. All we want our kids to do is survive. Listen, we want Christian kids that are running after Christ, that are proclaiming the word with boldness, not just hanging on for dear life. And so it was so refreshing for me as Sarah goes to college. Her mom and I, we get a text on the way home, and she said, hey, Dad, last night we had a fresh, you know, I mean, we had left her at 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock that night. We get a text. Dad, we've got a problem. I'm like, already? You've only been in college 4 hours? We've got a problem. At our freshman dorm meeting, stood up and I just mentioned to the girls, I said, listen, we're all new, and tomorrow is Sunday, and some of us are going to be going to church. And so if you guys would like to go to church with me and a couple other girls, we're going to meet out here at such and such time. And my daughter, the problem was so many girls said they wanted to go, they didn't have enough transportation. So this idea of sending our kids with this passivity of, man, I just hope that they get there and they can find a club and get in there, and maybe that's not what we're supposed to be about. What it's supposed to look like is something much different. There's a picture of Sarah in Uganda washing the feet of one of the boys that they had brought off the streets. But this idea, we teach what we know, but we reproduce who we are. I'm going to give you guys, because you did come to get kind of best practices, I want to lay out for you 7 things, and we're going to fly through these. The first one of this is this. One of the things that we need to do within our churches is we need to model it for our parents. Okay, we've been talking about that. We need to model this for our parents. The second thing that we need to do is we need to exhort believing parents to treasure Christ above all else. We need to teach believing parents to treasure Christ above all else. Because see, this is what happens with our little ones. There's a little, someone has their baby here this morning, right? Okay, what is?
Derek.
Okay, What will happen with Derek is he will wake up in the morning, because he's just a little fella. Those eyes will open up and he will begin to look around. And what will happen with little Derek is he will notice that his mom and dad, every morning, they jump on the treadmill. Now, he doesn't know what they're running after, but they're running after something. And this idea of what we treasure determines what we're running after. And it's so important that our parents understand it, because, listen, if we really, truly treasure the gospel, that's going to mean the way that we run the race and the way that we get on that treadmill and what even treadmill we get on is going to be completely 100% different than every other parent that lives in our cul-de-sac. And that would mean that our kids, when they see us get up and get on a treadmill, that it might look like sacrifice. It might look like doing without. It might look like us looking at pictures of young men, of families that are doing stuff like this. And it might be introducing our children to young men and young women that we have adopted and began to walk life with in foreign countries and other places, that without our help as a family, without us being on mission as a family, there is no hope that their lives, that they will ever hear Christ. And yet God has written eternity on the hearts of those boys and girls just as much as He has little Derek. So I encourage you, Mom, run hard after Jesus, run hard after the gospel, and let little Derek see that in your life. Let him see that. So the third thing is, we must teach parents the dangers of building idols. It's so easy for us in the U.S. We read the Old Testament, we're like, wow, what in the world were those people thinking? Building that golden calf, how crazy were they? But yet we do the same thing every single day. We do the same thing every single day, and our kids get to see the idols that we build, the things that are so important for us. And I'll just give you one example. Mom and Dad, if you have a teenager, one of the ways that they're able, or a teenager or a child, one of the ways that they're able to know what your idols are is by the questions that you always ask about. They come home from school, they open up the door, first words out of your mouth, "Son, I wanted you to know today, I was praying for you, that the glories of God would be made known through your life." How did that go? Were you able to witness to someone? Were you able to share Christ with someone? Were you able to encourage someone in their faith? That's the typical conversation, right? Typically, they open the door and what do we say? "How'd you do on that test? What time's football practice? How'd you do on that?" And so then the next day they come in and guess what we ask again? "Well, how about this test? Well, did you do your homework? When's the last time a kid has about to pull their hair out because mom and dad is like, "Hey, have you been in God's Word today?" But yet every day, the things that we idol drive the questions and the way that it's the rudder, right? So if we're passionate about Christ, guess what's going to come out of our mouth? We're going to ask. We're getting ready to start school. Mom and dad, those things that we lay out for our kids, that mission, they're able to hear it from us. "Hey, listen, when you go to school this year, be on mission for Christ." Genesis 11, they decide that they're going to build a tower. Right? Nothing wrong with building a tower, but they wanted to build a tower because they wanted to what? Make their name great. And that temptation is there every day for us. And so do our kids see practically and oozing out of every fiber of our body, this pursuit in our life? "My dad is living his life to make God's name great. That's all he cares about." Or are we trying to make our name great? Teach parents to live missionally. One way to live missionally with their children. One of the ways that we've done that in our home is when a couple of 10, 15 years ago, we found a little guy out in the jungles of Belize. His name was Lionel Rodriguez. Lionel became part of our family. He didn't have a mom and dad. And if you went to believes, and you ask Lionel, introduce yourself. What should he say? My name's Lionel Wright. Now, if you just met him down there in the jungle, he may say Lionel Rodriguez. But when he was studying abroad in the U.S., he introduced the whole semester. He introduced himself as Lionel Wright. He's been to our home many times. He spent the summer with us. We've flown him in for camp. When I met Lionel, he was 12 years old. He could speak 5 languages fluently. He lived in the jungle in Belize. And he was an amazing young man. And we just started doing life with him. My kids got to know Lionel. My wife got to know Lionel. We just started doing life with him. And when Lionel was 14, I said, Lionel, I want you to go to college when you graduate high school. And Lionel said, you're crazy. No one from my refugee camp has ever gone to college. Lionel was 16, I said, Lionel, now, when you go to college, I don't want you to just go to any college. I want you to go to Belize University. That would be like you telling your child today, I want you to go to Harvard. That was so foreign. He was like, are you, Pastor Steve, you've lost your mind. A few years ago, Lionel graduated from Belize University. December, my wife and I, we will fly to Belize because Lionel wanted me to be there when he got married. And he wanted me to do the wedding. And this idea of doing life and living it out with our kids and letting them see this, they're doing life with us. It's not just pictures on the commercials. It's doing life with them. It's so important. We equip parents to lead in their home, family worship. I could talk about this for a long time, but we make time for those things that we prioritize. For those things that we value, we make time for them. A couple of years ago, 7, 8, 10 years ago, one day I came in, we were meeting with our family, and I said, guys, what do you guys think that we value as a family? I mean, what are the things that we're going to do no matter what? And, we're just having conversation about it. And I don't know what it is. I'm like the biggest one in my family. So I'm like the fatso in my family. Everybody else in my family is skinnier than me. So we're like a skinny family. But for whatever reason, we like all of the big shows like Biggest Loser, Fat March. I don't know why, but I don't know if you guys remember that show. I had a friend of mine that was on it. Yeah. So we liked all of these shows because, you know, it's transformational and you're seeing life change, all of this stuff. And I mean, when those shows come on, man, we would run. Oh, we got to go to that. You know, we got to see it. How's he doing? Is he losing weight? What was that other TV show that's on that people watch a lot? Is it 23? I was joking. It's 24. All right. I mean, you know, when it would come on, hey, we got it, man. We're going to see that. Because we value it. And I asked my kids, I said, what do we value? Do we value 24? Because, you know, Jack Bauer, he died on the cross for us. I mean, Jack Bauer, he did it all. Or do we value God's word? And I said, look, this is what we're going to do. If we see that this is of value, then let's say on Monday nights we want to watch 24. If we've not had our family worship and we've not been together, we've not prayed together as family, guess what? We're not going to turn on the TV. And you know what happened with my kids when I said that? They rebelled and one of them ran away. No, I'm kidding. They're like, Dad, that's not a problem. We should have, yeah, we're in. But this idea of leading our family, and family worship is a great, great way to do that. And I would just encourage you, if you've not done it, do it and start slow and easy. It doesn't have to be a 4-hour, can be a 15-minute, 2 verses, and let's pray together. And do it. Number 6, in our church ministry, seek to resource, train, and involve parents with every single thing that we do. I don't have time to unpack that. I've written a lot about it in the book Rethink, so you guys have that. You can look at it. And then lastly,
you mean like in your youth ministry and children's ministry?
Yes. Yeah. How do we do every single thing that we do that resources, train, and involves parents as part of the mission of what we're doing? The first time I got ready to do this in our ministry, in a room like this, a little bit larger, but I said I wanted to begin to resource parents. And so we decided to pick one of our youth events, a Disciple Now weekend, and we said we're going to meet with the parents during this same time. It would only make sense. And what ended up happening was this. I came in and I had like a big dream and I pushed it hard. So I set up 50 chairs for our parents. I was really excited. I thought, man, if 50 parents came to this, it would be a great start. You know how many parents came? 272 parents came. See, I think a lot of times we're sitting on our hands and they're tied and we're like, well, man, the parents don't want to do it. I think, honestly, what I think is their parents, the reason some of you are here and have made a sacrifice to be, I think their parents are saying, man, train us, resource us, involve us. And we've got to learn how to do that. And that's why that's on there. It's critical. Lastly, and I really won't have time to unpack this, but as we're building our children's ministry, early childhood ministries, youth ministries, those ministries, we need to build a model off of what God intended rather than what society has broken. There's a tendency to go, well, you know, moms and dads aren't engaged. I need to do it. They're not speaking truth in their life. I need to do it. We need to build a model off of what God has intended. And you know what? If moms and dads aren't doing it, and if I have kids that are coming to my youth group and moms and dads aren't involved, then I've got to begin to plan my ministry model with the idea of what God has intended. And I don't really have a lot of time. I'd be glad to meet with some of you. If you're in a pastor role, I would love to break that down for you. Real quickly, and I hesitate to mention this, but one of the things that we're doing at Providence that may be a resource for you guys in the future, a free resource, so you can put an asterisk beside that, is we're working on a curriculum right now. It will not be ready this year. It will probably be a year out, probably by next fall. We hope to have it ready. And it's a curriculum for Sunday school, for early elementary, childhood, preteen, middle school, and high school. And basically what this curriculum will seek to do is this. Imagine if we were going to Iraq and we had the Navy, the Marines, the Army, everybody was there, Air Force. And we never came together to plan a coordinated effort. I think a lot of times that's what's happening in our church ministries on Sunday morning. This guy's doing this, this guy's doing this, and none of us know what really is. And so basically what this is to allow us to do is to have a comprehensive plan. And one of the things that we're hoping to do with this curriculum is have it translated into other languages, so that places that do not have the gospel, that do not have the access to curriculum like this, that they can use it for free as well. But it will be a free resource, and as we're developing it, you guys are more than welcome to have it and use it in your church as well. There will be a take-home piece that will help drive it. So there will be a family worship piece. And with that family worship piece, we will encourage mom and dads to study the scriptures together in preparation to what the children will be studying on Sunday mornings. Okay, so there's that home piece with that. And if any of you guys are curriculum, you've kind of got a passion for that and would maybe like to dream about that with us and maybe sharpen. There's probably 30, 40, 50 people across the nation that are ministry experts. Bruce Ware has given us insight. Timothy Jones. Tons and tons and tons and tons of people that are really qualified that are helping us with this. And so if you guys, what we're trying to do right now is we're just trying to throw something up on the wall and then just start critiquing it, working, shaping it to make it better. And so that process is happening right now. So we need to go ahead and break, because I think we're supposed to break at 12. Two things I'm going to give you, and then if you have questions, you can stay, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have. Number one, well, I guess if you guys ever wanted to bring in my daughter, if you guys had an idea for your youth, if perhaps your teenagers wanted to do something besides a Christian concert at Disney, with XYZ celebrity, fill in the blank, worship leader or preacher, but you wanted to really engage your children and teenagers in stuff that what we were talking about, like this. If you'd like to, you could email Sarah from her blog. You could look her up or me up on Facebook, and we could get you all that information. I know she would love to come in. And there's something powerful about having someone else their age sharing this testimony with them. And so I know this has happened in our church as Abby and others have impressed this on our teenagers. Instead of going on fun trips, wasting time, our kids are now, they're more impressed and more burned about getting kids off the street and the gospel going forth. And so if you guys, if that would be a resource that you guys could use. Secondly, I wanted to give you guys my email address. You can reach me at steve@pray.org. And I probably could never help you advance ideas that you have, but I could surely tell you if something looked wrong, because I've made all of the mistakes. And so if you wanted me to ever dream with you, or just if you just wanted to contact me and let me know how I could pray for you, it would be a great joy and privilege. You can look me up on Facebook if that's how you communicate, and I would count it a joy to continue the conversation with you. We're all in this together. We're all learning together. You guys may hear about some of the stuff we're doing at Providence and think, man, I feel like I'm one step ahead of some people, because we're all so new in this and we're learning together. And so I hope that God will continue to bless us and give us wisdom that we do not possess in and of ourselves.